The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
On this cold winter's night, I will read to you a story from the land of endless summer. And so here is a story from this little book I wrote called Hawaii One Summer. A sea worry. This summer, our son body surfs. He says it's his job and rises each morning at 5:30 to catch the bus to Sandy Beach. I hope that by September, he will have had enough of the ocean. Tall waves throw surfers against the shallow bottom. Undertows have snatched them away. Sharks prowl sandies. Joseph told me that once he got out of the water because he saw an enormous shark. "Did you tell the lifeguard?" I asked. "No." "Why not?" "I didn't want to spoil the surfing." The ocean pulls at the boys who turn into surfing addicts. At sunset, you can see surfers waiting for the last golden wave. "Why do you go surfing so often?" I ask my students. "It feels so good," they say. "Inside the tube." I can't describe it. There are no words for it. "You can describe it," I scold. "Everything can be described. Find the words for it, you lazy boy. Why don't you stay home and read?" I am afraid that the boys give themselves up to the ocean's mindlessness. When the waves are up, surfers all over Hawaii don't do their homework. They cut school. They know how the surf is breaking at any moment, because every 15 minutes the reports come over the radio. In fact, one of my former students is the surf reporter. Some boys leave for the mainland colleges and write their parents heart-rending letters. They beg to come home for Thanksgiving. "If I can just touch the ocean," they write from Missouri and Kansas, "I'll last for the rest of the semester." Some come home for Christmas and don't go back. Even when the assignment is about something else, the students write about surfing. They try to describe what it is to be inside the wave as it curls over them, making a tube or chamber or green room or pipeline or time warp. They write about the silence, the peace, no hassles, the feeling of being reborn as they shoot out the end. They've written about the voice of God, the commandments they hear. In the margins, they draw the perfect wave. Their writing is full of cliches. "The endless summer," they say, "unreal." Surfing is like a religion. Among the martyrs are George Helm, Kimo Mitchell, and Eddie Aikau. Helm and Mitchell were lost at sea, riding their surfboards from Kaho'olawe, where they had gone to protest the Navy's bombing of that island. Eddie Aikau was a champion surfer and lifeguard. A storm had capsized the Hokulea, the ship that traces the route that the Polynesian ancestors sailed from Tahiti. And Eddie Aikau had set out on his board to get help. since the ocean captivates our son, we decided to go with him to see Sandy's. Oh, by the way, Sandy's is our President Barack Obama's favorite beach. We got up before dawn, picked up his friend Marty, and drove out of Honolulu. Almost all the traffic was going in the opposite direction. The freeway coned to make more lanes into the city. We came to a place where raw mountains rose on our left and the sea fell on our right, smashing against the cliffs. The strip of cliff pulverized into sand is Sandy's. Dangerous current exist, said the ungrammatical sign. Earl and I sat on the shore with our blankets and thermos of coffee. Joseph and Marty put on their fins and stood at the edge of the sea for a moment, touching the water with their fingers and crossing their hearts before going in. There were 15 boys out there, all about the same age, 14 to 20, all with the same kind of lean, V-shaped build, most of them with black hair that made their wet heads look like sea lions. It was hard to tell whether our kid was one of those who popped up after a big wave. A few had surfboards, which are against the rules at a body surfing beach, but the lifeguard wasn't on duty that early. As they watched for the next wave, the boys turned toward the ocean. They gazed slightly upward. I thought of altar boys before a great God. When a good wave arrived, they turned, faced shore, and came shooting in, some taking the wave to the right and some to the left, their bodies fish-like, one arm out in front, the hand and fingers pointed before them like a swordfish's beak. A few held credit card trays, and some slid in on trays from McDonald's. That is no country for middle-aged women, I said. We had on bathing suits underneath our clothes in case we felt moved to participate. There were no older men either. Even from the shore, we could see inside the tubes. Sometimes when they came in at an angle, we saw into them a long way. When the wave dug into the sand, it formed a brown tube or a gold one. The magic ones, though, were made out of just water. Green and turquoise rooms, translucent walls and ceilings. I saw one that was powder blue, perfect, thin. The sun filled it with sky blue and white light. The best thing, the kids say, is when you are in the middle of the tube and there is water all around you, but you're dry. The waves came in sets. The boys passed up the smaller ones. Inside a big one, you could see their bodies hanging upright, knees bent, duck feet fins paddling, bodies dangling there in the wave. Once in a while, we heard a boy yell, "Awoo! Punta! Aroo!" And then we noticed how rare human voice was here. The surfers did not talk, but silently, silently rode the waves. Since Joseph and Marty were considerate of us, they stopped after 2 hours, and we took them out for breakfast. We kept asking them how it felt so that they would not lose language. "Like a stairwell in an apartment building," said Joseph, which I liked a lot. He hasn't been in very many apartment buildings, so had to reach a bit to get the simile. "I saw somebody I knew coming toward me in the tube, and I shouted, 'Jeff, hey, Jeff,' and my voice echoed like a stairwell in an apartment building. Jeff and I came straight at each other, mirror tube." "Are there ever girls out there?" Earl asked. "There's a few women who come at about 11, said Marty. "How old are they?" "Oh, about 20. Why do you cross your heart with water so the ocean doesn't kill us? I described the powder blue tube I had seen. That part of Sandy's is called Chambers, they said. I have gotten some surfing magazines, the ones kids steal from the school library, to see if the professionals try to describe the tube. Bradford Baker writes, "Round and pregnant in emptiness, I slide laughing into the sun, into the night." Frank Miller calls the surfer mother's fumbling, curly-haired, to-be-layered son. "Oh, offshores," writes Reno Abayera, "where wind and wave most often form that terminal rendezvous of love, when the wave can reveal her deepest longings, her crest caressed, cannily covered to form those peeling concavities we know, perhaps a bit irreverently, as tubes. Here we strive to spend every second enclosed, encased, sometimes fatefully entombed, and hopefully gleefully ejected. Whoosh! An iridescent ride through the entrails of God," says Gary L. Crandall. I am relieved that the surfers keep asking one another for descriptions. I also find some comfort in the stream of commuter traffic, cars filled with men over 20 passing Sandy Beach on their way to work. I want to wish everyone a happy new year. Today is New Year's Day, the new year, the lunar new year, and it is the year of the rabbit. And the predictions from China are that the year of the rabbit will be a very good one. It so happens that our son, Joseph, whom you just heard about surfing, he is a rabbit. You know the way the Chinese speak? You don't say, "I was born in the year of the rabbit." You say, "I am a rabbit." And I don't say, "I am born in the year of the dragon." I am a dragon. So here in my new book, I write about a son born in the year of the rabbit. Our son was born year of the rabbit. The character rabbit, under the character forest, under the radical home, equals the word magic. It's all right that he didn't graduate from a four-year college, didn't become an engineer, admire the magician most of all the artists. He makes something out of nothing, can himself become nothing. Son, I see your life. Your life flashes before me. I look at you, my son, and you are every age. I saw you being born, face first. I saw your face, eyes, mouth tight, then maw. You were mouth, all mouth, red tunnel into a universe. Then I saw your whole body, your hairy little wet body. You were so small. How can you make your way in the world? How could I, myself small, safeguard you? I saw you. I see you sit up an owlet in a nest, blinking big eyes at me, at everything, ears perky, hair perky. You were not a cuddle baby. You kicked and punched out of swaddling, out of diapers, out of the little gown. You sledded down the stairs in your walker, bawled at the bottom, alive. You said, "My eyes are little, but I can see so much." You're toddling downhill faster and faster and not falling. You're announcing, "I am second bull of second grade." Oh, I just now got it. You were in a fight. You came out second. I saw you take your time running the bases. You hit three men home, grand slam. You're popping up out of the ocean, alive. Rel's son, the queen of Makaha, was watching too. You're concentrating for an hour on the writer's test, on the written driver's test. You're telling us that you obey the law. You registered for the draft. I am constantly remembering you. Now I am going to read to you about my own birthday. And this is the very beginning of A Love Abroad Margin to my life. And I began writing this when I was turning 65 years of age. And I was beginning to worry about my mortality. I am turning 65 years of age. In 2 weeks, I will be 65 years old. I can accumulate time and lose time. I sit here writing in the dark. Can't see to change these penciled words. Just like my mother, alone, bent over her writing. Just like my father, bent over his writing, alone but for me watching. She got out of bed, wrapped herself in a blanket, and wrote down the strange sounds father, who was dead, was intoning to her. He was reading aloud calligraphy that he'd written, carved with ink brush on his tombstone. She wasn't writing in answer. She wasn't writing a letter. Who was she writing to? Nobody. This well-deep outpouring is not for anything. Yet we have to put into exact words what we are given to see, hear, know. Mother's eyesight blurred. She saw trash as flowers. Oh, how very beautiful. She was lucky, seeing beauty, living in beauty, whether or not it was there. I am often looking in mirrors and singling out my face in group photographs. Am I pretty at 65? What does old look like? Sometimes I am wrinkled, sometimes not. So much depends upon lighting. A camera crew shot pictures of me, one of five most influential people over 60 in the East Bay. I am homely. I am old. I look like a tortoise in a curly white wig. I am stretching head and neck toward the light. Such effort to lift the head, to open the eyes, black, shiny, lashless eyes, talking mouth. I must utter you something. My wrists are crossed in my lap. Wrinkles run up the left forearm. It's my right shoulder that hurts. Rollerblading accident. Does the pain show? Does my hiding it? I should have spoken up. Don't take my picture. Not in that glare. One side of my neck and one cheek are gone in black shadow. Nobody looks good in hard focus. High contrast. Black sweater and skirt. White hair, white sofa, white curtains. My colors and my home, but rearrange. The crew had pushed the reds and blues and greens aside. The photographer, a young woman, said, "Great, great." From within my body, I can't sense that crease on my left cheek. I have to win compliments. "You are beautiful. So cute. Such a kind face. You are simple. You move fast. Chocolate chip." A student I taught long ago called me Chocolate Chip. And only yesterday, a lifelong friend told Earl, my husband, "He's lucky. He's got me, the chocolate chip." They mean, I think, my round face and brown bead eyes. I keep count. I mind that I be good looking. I don't want to look like grandmother. Ah, Paul, her likeness is the mask of tragedy. An ape weeps when another ape weeps. She is ancestress. She is prayed to. She sits, the queen, center of the family in China. Center of the family portrait. My mother in it too. Generations of in-laws around her. All is black and white, but for a dot of jade green at Paw's ears and a curve of jade green at her wrist. Lotus lily feet show from the hem of her gown. She wanted to be a beauty. She lived to be 100. My mother lived to be 100. 103, she said. Chinese lie about their age, making themselves older. Or maybe she was 97 when the lady official from Social Security visited her as the government visits everyone who claims a 100th birthday. Mama showed off. She pedaled her exercise bike, hammer-curled hot pink barbells, suddenly stopped. What if Social Security won't believe she's a century old? Here's a way for calculating age. Subtract from her age of death my age now. 100 minus 65 equals 35. I am 35 years to go. Lately, I've been writing a book a decade. I have time to write 3 more books. Jane Austen wrote 6 books. I've written 6 books. Hers are 6 big ones. Mine, 4 big ones and 2 small ones. I take refuge in numbers. I waste my time with Sudoku. Day dawns, I am greedy, helpless to begin 6-star difficulty Sudoku. Sun goes down, I'm still stuck for that square that will let the numbers fly into place. What good am I getting out of this? I'm not stopping time. Nothing to show for my expenditures. Pure nothing. 8 days before my birthday, I went to John Mulligan's funeral. He was 10 years younger than me. He died without finishing his book America. I have a superstition that as long as I, any writer, have things to write, I keep living. I joined in singing again and again a refrain, "Send thou his soul to God." Earl, though, did not sing, did not say any of the Latin, any of the prayers. He muttered that the Catholic Church divides you against yourself, against your sexy body. The church is a gyp. John Mulligan should have been given a pagan ceremony. Woman warrior Robert Louis Stevenson and Cuchulainn had come to him in Vietnam. John carried them, tied to him by silver cords, to the U.S. The priest who came from the Philippines kept reminding one and all that the benefits he was offering were for Christians only. But he did memorialize John being born and raised in Scotland and coming to America at 17, summarily drafted to Vietnam. You didn't have to be a citizen to be drafted. The war count as of today: almost 2,000 killed in Iraq. GIs, not counting Afghanis, Iraqis, civilians, mercenaries, children, babies, journalists. 7 days before my birthday, I had breakfast with Mary Gordon, who's always saying things I never thought before. It's capitalistic of us to expect any good from peace demonstrations, as if ritual has to have use, gain, profit. I agreed. Yes, it's Buddhist to go parading for the sake of parading. Can you think of a writer besides Chekhov who is holy and an artist? Grace Paley. She smiled. Well, yes, obviously. Thoreau. Oh, no, Thoreau's too Protestant. Tidy, non-sexual. He goes home to mom for hot chocolate. No sex, no tragedy, no humor. Come to think of it, Thoreau doesn't make me laugh. A line from Walden hangs over one of my desks. I love a broad margin to my life. Sitting here at this sidewalk cafe with Mary, deliberately taking time off from writing and teaching duties, I am making a broad margin to my life. The margin will be broader when we part and I am alone. Thoreau swam, then sat in the doorway of his shelter, large box, dwelling house. Alone all the summer morning, wrapped in the sunlight and the trees and the stillness, birds flitted through the house. Until by the sun falling in at my west window or the noise of some traveler's wagon on the distant highway, I was reminded of the lapse of time. I have a casita of my own, built instead of a garage after the big fire. Its width is the same as the Thoreau's, 10 feet. Its length a yard longer. He had a loft. I have a skylight. I want to be a painter. Sometimes I hear the freeway, now and again the train and the campanile. Thoreau heard the band playing military music. His neighbors were going to war against Mexico. He made up his mind not to pay taxes. Trying broad margin meditation, I sit in the sunny doorway of my casita amidst the yucca and loquats and purple rain birches. Some I planted, some volunteered. Birds, chickadees, finches, sparrows, pairs of doves, a pair of towhees, and their enemy, the jay. Hawk overhead, barn swallows at twilight. I know, Thoreau sat with notebook and pencil in hand. Days full of writing. Days full of wanting. Let them go by without worrying. Without worrying that they do. Stay where you are, inside such a pure, hollow note. Those last four lines are from Rumi. Now I am going to read something from the end of I Love a Broad Margin to My Life. At the end of this book, as I was writing this book, so many friends died, and I wanted to write an elegy to each one, but there were so many, so I ended up listing my dead, and I could feel that everyone who dies, I wanted to go with them. I felt them drawing me to them as they were going somewhere else. And then I began to see what I was writing is an anti-suicide poem. I wanted to die with my dead, but I was trying to find a way to keep living and living vitally and vigorously. And so I thought, well, what if I ended the poem by writing a list of reasons why I should keep living? And so I found seven reasons. And after I finished writing the seven reasons, I thought, my gosh, this looks like a to-do list. And since I am a very responsible person, I thought, okay, so I've got to keep living because I've got to finish my to-do list. So I am going to read to you the fourth reason why I will live on. And this is a little story or a little poem about something that happened to my mother at the very last part of her life. Toward the end of her life, living alone, Mama accidentally locked herself out of the house and spent the winter night outside. She wrapped the old dog blanket around herself, but could not sleep. She walked around and around the house. She tried lying down in various places on the ground. She got up and walked to the front yard and saw Kuan Yin on the porch. The house looked like a resplendent altar. The porch railings were altar rails. Kuan Yin was watering the flowers and plants that adorned like spring, red, red, green, green. Kuan Yin stood at the top of the stairs and saw my mother. Mama knelt on the cement and was warm with joy and beauty and delight. Many, many children came. Kuan Yin and Mama walked among them, touching them on their bald heads. When we found her, She was asleep on the porch in a spot of morning sun.
Thank you, Maxine, for sharing that with us. Folks, I think you know how this works. Raise your hand. We'll get a mic to you. Please wait for the microphone before you ask your question. Who would like to start us off? No? Well, okay.
Do going to readings like this all around the country, do you look forward to it or do you dread it? Is it a combination of those? And how do you prepare for it?
I love reading to my readers and listeners, and I do get stage fright, and hours or days before I'm about to do something, I get scared and stage fright. But my husband, who is an actor, tells me that that stage fright is energy, and that you can use it to enliven what you're doing. I feel really good that I have now being 70 years old, I have enough work so that I can think about an audience and who I think they are, and then I can find the stories that I think would be appropriate for them to hear.
Maxine, how did you come to surfing for Philadelphia?
Because it is so cold, and my boots are leaking, and the snow and the sleet and the storm of the century, and I thought that you would like to hear something warm. You know, I saw a group of what looked like students come in sort of late, and since you look like students, I assume that you are reading my work, and if you have any student-type questions, if you want to ask me anything that would help with your exam or your paper, please raise your hand and ask.
After this gentleman right here, though.
Maybe I will join that class. I don't know. I wanted to know if you could talk a little bit about how this latest book evolved for you when you started thinking about it, and how it took the form it did.
Oh, about half a dozen years ago, I was working on the fifth book of Peace, and that is the book that burned in the Oakland Berkeley Hills fire. And afterwards, I tried to figure out how to create again after everything, after so much was lost. And I did get going on that book with the help of my writers group, which was war veterans, but even with the help of the writers group, it took me 10 years to write the fifth book of Peace, and before that, it took 10 years to write the Tripmaster Monkey, and as the years went by, I I just yearned for a faster, happier, easier form. And I put those thoughts into some notes, and which is called To Be the Poet. And I wanted to be a poet because a poet's life is easy. A poet's have it so easy. The poets have the muses come to the poet and just give you the poems. And you don't have to struggle like the prose writer. And so I was thinking like that, and I was believing that that writing poetry, I could hasten the pace of creation, and it did work. And so this book only took 4 years.
Yes, right here in the second row.
You touched on the fact that you are doing a writing group with war veterans, and since I'm doing that as well, I wondered what it's like, sort of looking back, how it's affected your life after having done it for so many years. Like, what is the impact on your life and also our broader culture?
Oh, everybody, this is Lavella. How do you say your last name? Lavella Kalika, and she. Runs a writing workshop for veterans, and they're called the Warrior Writers. And she also belongs to the writing workshop that we have in California, which is called the Veteran Writers Group. And we meet every season. At the beginning, we would meet for days at a time and go on retreat. And We meditate together. We have walking meditation, which changes the military march into this loving, peaceful walk on the earth. We have eating meditation, in which we break bread together and form our community and our sangha. And we write together, and we read our work to one another. And just before we read our work, I ring the bell of mindfulness, which is the voice of the Buddha, and I evoke Kuan Yin, the Bodhisattva of compassionate listening. And then we all listen to one another's work. Lavella's question was, how did it change me? It changed me, and it changed everybody. But let me just tell you a little bit about changing the veterans. Everybody who comes to the group, maybe everybody after a war, they have post-traumatic stress disorder, all kinds of emotional troubles, troubles with relationships. After years of expressing themselves, listening to one another, forming a loving community, everybody changes. People now have relationships. They are, I think, just about everybody went from being a warrior to a pacifist. The most amazing thing, gathered 80 pieces of writing, 40 stories, 40 poems, and published them in a book called Veterans of War, Veterans of Peace. And the veterans voted that we are not going to receive money, our royalties. We're going to give them to organizations that work for peace, especially organizations in Vietnam, because most of the veterans are Vietnam. I just got to tell you one quick one. There's a veteran named Sandy Skull. He's a poet, and he was a poet from when he was in high school, a young man, and then he went to Vietnam, and he lost his poetry. In the war, he could not write poems anymore, and he lost his poetry for 30 years. In Vietnam, he was in Quang Tri, and there he built an airstrip. 30 years goes by. He comes to our writing workshop. He writes the poems. We get them published. We make money. We send the money to Quang Tri, where they built a school. Okay, so that's the changes that we make.
About four rows back.
Thank you for coming. I love Tripmaster Monkey.
Oh, thank you.
Really love it. And I think this goes along with what you were just saying about kind of change, too. At the end of Midsummer Night's Dream, the Mechanicals kind of take a tragedy and turn it into a comedy. And I feel like Whitman and Tanya do that at the end of Tripmaster. They take a kind of war epic and kind of turn it into a kind of a community healing comedy of sorts. Do you see that happening in fiction at all today or anything you can think of, or do you think it's kind of turned into what you're doing now in terms of active writing workshops? Like, how do you, in other words, with the stuff that's going on now in Egypt and elsewhere, war, tragedy, how is that getting turned into the peacefulness that you're seeing in the writing workshops? Do you see it happening, or where?
You are, maybe I'm not well read enough, but I don't know that in books, do you mean like in popular fiction today? Offhand, I can't think of anything else, but in the work that the veterans are doing in our workshops and writing veterans of war, veterans of peace, and also in the books that Lavella has edited, I do see people writing what happens when you write a story is that you throw all your tragedy, all your conflicts, your bad feelings, you just throw them into the story, and the shape of the story itself will take you to the big confrontation, which is the dramatic high point, and then carrying out the story further, you get to resolution and meaning and revelation. And so within the story itself, you can arrive at that good place. Not necessarily comedy, as we were talking about Tripmaster Monkey, but this is the process that I see the veteran writers go for. And after I go home and back to the hotel, in the middle of the night, I will think of just the right answer for you. Unless somebody else can think of that story that he just described, of this war tragic story ending in comedy. Anybody? Does Catch 22 count? It's sort of satirical throughout, though, huh? It's not really arriving at the pure land. Okay, I see one of those students. Yeah. She's got her hand up.
Hi. Wow. We're actually studying one of your books in our class right now, Warrior Woman. I know it's been a while, but Woman Warrior? Yeah. Actually, we are also studying Frank Chin, and I was wondering, what are your thoughts on what he said about some of the parts of Woman Warrior.
Oh, what she's talking about is one of my very early critics, and his name is Frank Chin. And now we're talking about 35 years ago when I first came out with A Woman Warrior. And this critic, mind you, we are beginning ethnic studies. For the first time, we're getting African-American studies. We're getting Chicano studies, Native American studies, Asian American studies. All these ethnic groups are being defined, have enough history and works in order to field courses at universities. Okay, so I come out with this book, and Frank Chin says that I am not a real Chinese, that I am a fake Chinese, and that I am not a Chinese American. And especially, he said that I am castrating Chinese men because I am writing about a false culture in which I say that Chinese culture is sexist and against women. And he also says said that that I misuse the myths of China, that I don't tell them correctly. This is a very different idea that he has than I have. To him, myths have a certain set way of being told. But to me, myths change constantly, and that when myths come from China and they're imported to America, then we have our new way of telling them, and now these myths belong to all of us. I think it's very interesting that African American men critics also criticize African American women writers in the same way, using the same rhetoric, also accusing African American women of castrating the men and all that. We get the same thing from the Chicano writers, it's really interesting how all our ethnic groups went through this. I think by now this question, I really think it's over, mostly because so many of all of us are writing stories that are so different from everyone else. See, what happened in the early days is that as each one of us wrote, as we came forward, we'd be the only one out there, and everyone expected me to represent the entire race. But now there are so many of us, and we write so differently from one another that I don't think each of us needs to carry the burden of the whole race anymore.
And I think it's time for us to move on. Please join me in thanking Maxine Hunter.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit, and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.